The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
This summer, your favorite characters from that movie you liked are back.
Harry Potter.
In a whole new adventure. Yeah. It's just like the previous adventure, only a little bit worse.
Dozens of unknown spacecraft have just been sighted around the world. It's just been confirmed that these ships are of alien origin, possibly to plan an attack.
They've returned from 3 million light years away. Only this time, they've come to stay. Now, E.T. and Elliot hold the only key to stopping them.
It takes more than just an understanding of the basic anatomy. You have to learn how to catch
13 years after the first Harry Potter book was published, I'm still astonished and delighted by the response the story's met. Even though the 7th book and the 8th film have now been completed, I'm still receiving hundreds of letters every week, and Harry's fans remain as enthusiastic and inventive as ever.
James Bond came through the door and shut it behind him. He walked over to the chair across the desk from M and sat down. Morning, 007. Good morning, sir.
James Bond, written by Ian Fleming.
There was silence in the room except for the rasping of M's pipe. It seemed to be taking a lot of matches to get it going. In the background, the fingers of the sleet slashed against the two broad windows. It was all just as Bond had remembered it through the months of being shunted from hospital to hospital, the weeks of dreary convalescence, the hard work of getting his body back into shape. To him, this represented stepping back into life. Sitting here in this room opposite M was the symbol of normality he had longed for. He looked across through the smoke clouds into the shrewd grey eyes. They were watching him. What was coming? A post-mortem on the shambles which had been his last case. A curt relegation to one of those home sections for a spell of desk work. Or some splendid new assignment M had been keeping on ice while waiting for Bond to get back to duty.
On the water, more than darkness in the depths. See him surface in every shadow.
Ian Fleming, written by Sebastian Foakes.
It took Bond almost 10 minutes to get the locomotive, the Bentley Continental he'd had rebuilt to his own specification, as far as Sloane Square. London seemed to have gone slightly off its head in the time he'd been away. Every zebra crossing on the King's Road was packed with long-haired young people, ambling across, standing and talking, or in one remarkable case, sitting cross-legged in the road. All too soon he was in Regent's Park, then at the headquarters of the service. At her station outside M's door sat Miss Moneypenny, a tailored Cerberus at the gates of whatever underworld awaited him. "James," she said, failing to keep the elation from her voice. "How wonderful to see you. How was your holiday?" "Sabbatical, Moneypenny. Anyway, it was fine. And how's my favourite gatekeeper?" Miss Moneypenny wore a severe black and white houndstooth suit with a white blouse and a blue cameo brooch at the throat. But her skin was flushed with girlish excitement. Bond inclined his head towards the door. "And the old man?" Miss Moneypenny made a sucking noise over her teeth. "A bit cranky, to be honest, James. He's taken up..." She crooked her finger in invitation to him to come closer. As he inclined his head, she whispered in his ear. Bond felt her lips against his skin. "Yoga!" Bond exploded.
"Other girls, they gather around him. If I had him, I wouldn't let him out."
When a work of fiction really works, it seems almost inevitable that others will want to copy it. We're well used to this happening in the film world for undoubtedly crude commercial reasons. When it's a work of literature, the motives are more complex. Admiration, imagination, speculation about future outcomes of the characters, and, of course, commercial opportunity as well. So sequels have always been with us, but is it my imagination, or is it true that just recently they've been more with us than ever before? We've got new Sherlock Holmes stories and a James Bond follow-up, not to mention Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, who is also riding again thanks to the sharp commercial brain of the Ian Fleming estate. And now the former poet laureate Andrew Motion has written Silver, a follow-up to Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. So how does a 21st century poet begin to essay the style of a 19th century popular novelist? Let's begin with a little comparison. First Stevenson, then Motion.
Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey, and the rest of these gentlemen, having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted, I take up my pen and go back to the time when my father kept the Admiral Benbow Inn and the brown old seaman with the sabre cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a handbarrow. A tall, strong, heavy, nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulder of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred with black, broken nails, and the sabre-cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking round the cover and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out in that old sea-song that he sang so often afterwards. 15 men on the dead man's chest, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum.
I'm going to read a bit from Silver, which is a novel that describes the return to Treasure Island. It's 40 years later, and it's the children who go back, but in order for them to be able to go back, the son of the original Jim Hawkins, who's also called Jim, and the daughter of Mr. Silver, as he now rather respectably is. But in order for them to go back, they have to get the map. So Jim 2, my Jim, steals the map from his father and brings it to the now extremely old, vestigial person that Mr. Silver has become, a kind of cobweb man. I saw Mr. Silver was leaning so far towards me, he had almost fallen onto the floor. Natty moved quickly to his side and knelt to straighten him. His only response was to batter her lightly with feeble hands. Spot, Natty's minor bird, did not like being passed over by his mistress in this way and began calling his name very angrily from his cage on the table, which convinced me that I should intervene. I went over to run my fingers along his bars, whereupon he spluttered like an ancient and outraged gentleman, then fell silent. Now Mr. Silver was settled again. He began hissing at his daughter. "Let me see it," he whispered, rolling his eyes feverishly to and fro in their sockets. "Let me hold it in my hands again." While I began to undo my shirt, Mr. Silver clawed the air as he had done during our previous visit. "I have it here, Mr. Silver." It was my voice that spoke now, and my hands that were holding out the map. I had already unfolded it, which meant I was seeing it in daylight for the first time. The underlinings appeared even more childish than one had glanced at them in my father's room. Yet the names and the rusty cross marks, held such extraordinary power, the air seemed to shiver around me. "Give it to me," he said. "I need to be sure." His voice was very thin and scratchy, but had a note of command that Captain Flint himself would have obeyed. When I did as he ordered, he laid hold of the paper with great delicacy, as if he feared it might melt between his fingers. When he had stroked it a few times, and reassured himself of its robustness, he raised it close to his face and breathed in two or three times very deeply. "Do you smell it, boy?" he asked in a much quieter voice. "And you, my girl, do you smell it? The sea and the earth and all that in them is." He caressed the whole surface of the map with a most lingering fondness, which made the snake tattoo writhe along his arm. Next, he performed the same action with his face, sliding the paper backwards and forwards across his white bristles, over his nose and forehead. Finally, he held it to his lips and puckered them into a tender kiss. It was a revolting performance.
Andrew Motion there, reading from his new book, Silver. Quite a challenge to take on a timeless success like Treasure Island, I put to him.
Yes, I think it probably is. And for that reason, and all the things that you imply as you put that question, I was very anxious not to write a sequel in the ordinarily understood sense of that word. In fact, I think the whole history of sequels is really enough to make you think that they pave the way to damnation for writers. And for a very simple reason, which is to say that a sequel that takes on its original at its own game is entering into a competition that it's bound to lose. So don't do that. If you must interfere with an existing text, do it, I think, in a way which allows you a great deal of freedom. I've never used the word sequel in connection with this book. It's described in its subtitle as a return to. It's 40 years later. We do meet Mr. Silver, but he is on his way out. I mean, he's virtually a dead man. I mean, that's the only connection, really, that it has with the cast that Robert Louis Stevenson gives us. And from that, all kinds of freedoms and possibilities arise. I mean, it seemed to me, doing it, that Stevenson himself is very inviting of the idea that a sequel might be written. He leaves all the silver on the island. Long John Silver is allowed to escape at the end of Treasure Island. He leaves three Maroons on the island as the Hispaniola sails away. So what on earth happened to them? There's also a great deal to be said about the way in which the original plot of Treasure Island is a kind of mash-up, as we might say these days. But once again, I want to say that I didn't want to do this in a way which trod on the heels of, on the august heels of Stevenson himself too closely, but was something that kicked off from it, but was allowed to become something in its own right.
I loved the way you described Long John Silver, who Stevenson described as like a ham, yes, as a cobweb of a man. I was wondering if you were slightly inviting trouble with that.
I suppose so, yes. I mean, he's got to be, for the story that I decided I want to tell, he has to be there. But what I've done is to, I mean, self-evidently what I've done is to bring him back to England, to allow him to hook up again with his wife, which Stevenson very glancingly tells us he has in Treasure Island, the woman of colour. Stevenson describes her as his old negress, he refers to her as. He's a bit of a reformed character, but we have to feel that there is sufficient menace and drive in him still, to, as well as money, to power the trip that the kids make. I mean, I think there is another way of speaking about that, if I may tread on my own heels in saying this, which is that the not very secret, deep emotional engine in almost all Stevenson's fiction is to do with children's relationship with their fathers. We know that in his life he had quite complicated relations with his father. We see it very obviously in Kidnapped. It's there too, I think, in Treasure Island. He has to kind of get rid of the father figure at the beginning of the novel so that Jim can then have his own life. As it happens, I started writing this book and thinking about it seriously and then writing it quite soon after the death of my own father. And my secret engine is my own feelings about my father in this book. And it's powered, I think, throughout by such feelings, Jim's own feelings about the guilt and competitiveness that he feels for his dad. And also, of course, the peculiar feelings that Natty has for Mr. Silver, who we understand is rather a sort of creepy person in her life and may even have interfered with her in some quite serious way. It doesn't go into that in any detail in the book, but there's a sort of shuddering acknowledgement that that might have indeed have happened. So both of them go on the trip partly because they want to get the money, but also because they have something to get away from.
Now, Jim, just to get the story straight, he runs a pub, but not the same pub as his father ran.
That's
when
right.
He was,
well, exactly,
narrating the original.
At the beginning of Treasure Island, as everybody remembers, the original father figure dies. Blind Pew and everybody turns up. Young Jim goes off on the voyage to Treasure Island, and the novel ends with him coming back, having become immensely rich in the process. What I've done is assume that he goes back to his mum, who's still living in the Admiral Benbow, stays with her until about the age of 18, giving her some money and looking after her and being nice. Then he comes to town alone and spends a lot of money, lives high on the hog, and blows most of what he's earned on the island, then gets married himself and goes to run a pub on the Thames estuary in a rather kind of Dickensian way, because there are various other books that haunt this book, Great Expectations being one of them. And while he's there, his wife has their son, My Jim, Jim 2. And by the time my book opens, My Jim, Jim 2, is 18 years old, which is roughly the same age as Long John Silver's daughter.
It's not only a book of human characters, is it? Notably, the ghost of Captain Flint
Indeed.
Hovers over it. Is the minor bird who we've just met in the reader, is that a familiar of Captain Flint, who was the parrot
That's
on Long
right.
John's
Well, yes.
Shoulder?
I thought there had to be lots of animals and some completely sort of invented animals as well, which I'll come to in a moment. So Natty herself has her own pet, which is called Spot. And of course, I was thinking of the black spot that Pew gives to everybody he wants to die. But when they get to the island, they find that not only are the Maroons living in this sort of demonic way that they are, having re-enslaved most of the slaves in a slave ship that has crashed into the island in the interval, so they're living in a kind of Joseph Conrad world, dystopia. The reason they've been able to sustain themselves such a long time is that the island is full of creatures that they've been eating, including some imaginary ones. And it was my daughter who said, why don't you make some animals up? Mainly they've been eating a thing called the doodah, which is really like the dodo. And there's also an enormous squirrel the size of a small pony that crashes through the trees and breaks off a lot of branches. So there is a kind of comedic element to this. But I thought, well, it's roughly in the same longitude and latitude as Galapagos, so why not make up these creatures? Jim and one or two others, and Natty, go back to the site of the compound where the horrible Maroons have been living, and they free from an animal pen that the Maroons have built all the creatures that they've been saving up for themselves to eat. This is one of the bits of the book that I especially enjoyed writing, I must say, where they just release the animals back into the wild.
You are smiling broadly through this. You've enjoyed this process.
I absolutely loved writing it. I really loved writing it. By and large, I have enjoyed writing the books that I've written. I've enjoyed some of them because I felt very tested by them, others because I felt very challenged by them, and others because I felt able to say something that I wanted to sort of put down. But in this case, I felt a sort of gleefulness about invention that I've never given myself permission to enjoy before. All the other extended pieces of prose that I've written have felt in some way or other responsible to their subject. I did feel responsible to my subject in this, and it is about very serious things, this book. It's about imperialism and greed and growing up and violence and all kinds of big stuff. But the opportunity to present all that in a way which simultaneously allowed me to tell a ripping yarn was wonderful for me. And it happened to coincide with a time in my life, and I think it wouldn't have been possible to do such a thing had this not happened. I wrote it on a kind of big surfer's wave that broke out of my father's death, stopping being laureate and getting married again. I wrote it in the very early morning. I sat down at 5:30 every morning for a year and a half and wrote the first draft of it, sort of 3 hours a day, with a broad smile on my face, even when I was writing about quite tragic things.
So you've got two strands of interest in this, it strikes me. One is the sort of storytelling, swashbuckling side of it. But the other is quite scholarly, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned Dickens.
Yes.
You talk about Stevenson being a great writer of islands, possibly one of the greatest ever writers of islands.
I think so. I was very interested. I am still very interested in the idea that you might take a thing like this, and in a way which is at once completely serious and profoundly playful, muck around with a received story. Stevenson himself appears in the book. I mean, the man who keeps a lookout sits in the crow's nest while they sail over to Treasure Island is called Mr. Stevenson, and it is Stevenson. He's literally keeping an eye on everything. But to use a word that comes nowhere near the sort of language in which I wrote the book, I wrote the book being very well aware of intertextualities of one kind or another. Of course, and primarily between the thing that I was making and its source book, Treasure Island itself. So there's quite a lot of broken up quotation from Treasure Island scattered, sprinkled through the book. But also two other books in particular. One, and more glancingly, is Great Expectations, which we've already mentioned. And the other, which is much more central to what I was thinking about and also does get quoted from once or twice in the book, in a not too ostentatious way, I hope, but people might be able to spot it, is Heart of Darkness. I've always thought that Stevenson and Conrad had a very interesting literary relationship. Stevenson, by and large, is the person who gets the big sales and isn't much spoken about by academics. Conrad is the person who sells within the academy, sure, but whose popular readership is rather smaller than Stevenson's, but gets all the kind of high ground cred. Actually, by and large, they're writing about the same thing. And I think the literary relationship they have with each other is a very interesting and overlapping one. And I thought that it would be interesting to write a book that brought those two things finally together.
When you first told me that you were doing this, I was really, really surprised. I thought it was a bit of a money spinner. If you're honest, is it a bit of a money spinner?
Well, it's certainly true that I don't have very much money, so I needed to earn some money. But I would never go about doing that. in a way that I felt sold me out. I mean, if lots of people buy it, and if somebody wants to make a film of it or a TV serial of it, I'll be thrilled to bits. I mean, who could not be thrilled to bits by such a thing? But I would feel, and I would only feel uneasy about it if I felt that I'd betrayed myself, but I absolutely don't feel I've betrayed myself. And although I can understand completely why you might feel it surprising, because it seems to be quite a far cry from lyric poetry, as it happens, I have written two other books which are voiced by 19th century figures. I wrote a small novella imagining what might have happened to John Keats if he hadn't died after I'd finished writing my Keats biography. So I do have form, actually, in this world. It's not, perhaps, therefore, as surprising as it might seem at first glance.
Who is the reader of this book?
Anybody over the age of 13, 14, I think.
Boys, girls?
Well, there's a girl in it. There are no girls in Treasure Island. The girl in it, Natty, has to go in disguise, because to go as a girl would have just been simply too complicated, given the time and all that. But you raise a very interesting question in saying that. What is a children's book now? Who is a book by Philip Pullman for? Who is a book by J.K. Rowling for? I don't think we know the answer to that anymore in the cut-and-dried ways that we used to, and that's fine by me. I would be disappointed if somebody got to the end of my book and thought it was just a jolly good yarn. I mean, I want it to be a jolly good yarn, but I want them to come out thinking about what it is to grow up, what it is to consider yourself to be a child of the Enlightenment and have to deal with pre-Enlightenment problems, which is really what they have to do in the book, and in particular what it is to have a complicated relationship with parents and try and find your own way through the world.
Some were going to New Zealand, but we are going to Newcastle to give the girls a chance. Heave away, heave away, my jollies, heave away, heave.
Some were going. Of course, some of the most sequelised of all books are Ian Fleming's. Geoffrey Deaver's Carte Blanche last year became the 37th James Bond book written since Fleming's death. But Sherlock Holmes can give him a run for his money, with outings ranging from The Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes in 1944 to A Three-Pipe Problem in 1975. And that's just the books. Here's a taster of Conan Doyle's inimitable style.
The Hound of the Baskervilles. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who was usually very late in the mornings, save upon those not infrequent occasions when he was up all night, was seated at the breakfast table. I stood upon the hearth rug and picked up the stick which our visitor had left behind him the night before. It was a fine, thick piece of wood, bulbous-headed, of the sort which is known as a Penang lawyer. Just under the head was a broad silver band, nearly an inch across. To James Mortimer, MRCS, from his friends of the CCH, was engraved upon it, with the date 1884. It was just such a stick as the old-fashioned family practitioner used to carry, dignified, solid, and reassuring. "Well, Watson, what do you make of it?" Holmes was sitting with his back to me, and I had given him no sign of my occupation. "How did you know what I was doing? I believe you have eyes in the back of your head." "I have, at least, a well-polished, silver-plated coffee pot in front of me," said he.
Well, Anthony Horowitz certainly thinks we can still do more with the character of the Baker Street detective. As he writes on his website, he set out to write Sherlock Holmes's darkest case, The House of Silk. He's here with me now to read a passage.
"Influenza is unpleasant," Sherlock Holmes remarked, "but you were right in thinking that, with your wife's help, the child will recover soon." "I very much hope so," I replied, then stopped and gazed at him in wide-eyed astonishment. My tea had been halfway to my lips, but I returned it to the table with such force that the cup and the saucer almost parted company. "But for heaven's sake, Holmes," I exclaimed, "you have taken the very thoughts from my head. I swear I have not uttered a word about the child nor his illness. You know that my wife is away, that much you might have deduced from my presence here, but I have not yet mentioned to you the reason for her absence, and I am certain that there has been nothing in my behaviour that could have given you any clue."
So that's old Watson there.
It is an older Watson, because my book is written in about 1914, and he's by now in an old people's home reminiscing about a case that took place in 1890.
And he's all by himself. Everybody else has predeceased him.
Yes, Holmes has died. That's the only thing, the only quibble I had from the Holmes fans after this book came out was that I actually dared to mention when the great man had died, but inevitably he would have. In the books, we know he retires and is last seen keeping bees. But I don't think many people ever mention the fact that he might actually have been mortal.
You've done very well with your own stories, not least with the Alex Rider stories, which one could say is a homage in some senses to James Bond, actually.
Very much inspired by Ian Fleming, definitely.
Inspired. So why did you want to do this? Why did you want to take on someone else's character?
Well, I didn't. Somebody came knocking on my door, representing the Doyle estate, and said, would you like to? And it took me about 2 seconds to make up my mind, because on the one hand, I had a certain nervousness that this is a type of publishing which could be accused of being cynical and out to make money. You take a very well-known title and you then do a spin-off, a sequel, a prequel, an add-on, a new take, whatever. And that's not really what I do. For me, the greatest fun in writing is invention. But at the same time, I'd read Sherlock Holmes when I was 17. I loved the character. And it was an absolute gift to a writer to be invited to spend time with two of the greatest characters in English literature, to write in the style of one of the greatest writers, to live with some of the most wonderful and memorable characters. How could I say no? So I didn't. I said yes.
Did they put any pressure on you to take any particular lines?
No. One of the first rules I set down was that nobody would give me any notes at all. Nobody would know what the book was about. Nobody would read the manuscript until I sent it to the publisher. And even then, I would not take notes from anybody outside the editor. I thought it was quite important not to become a servant of the Doyle estate or anybody else or to sort of any vested interests, but to write the book that I wanted to write.
Now, we heard from Andrew Motion earlier that he doesn't like the word sequels. He doesn't think that he's written a sequel. Are you squeamish about that word?
Well, The House of Silk isn't a sequel. I mean, it's the sort of the classic lost mystery in the canon that's been dug out of the vault.
Oh, you see, you're doing it as well.
I can understand his point. I mean, a sequel is a continuation of somebody else's ideas, whereas a pastiche, an homage, a new novel is one's own perspective on that work, if you like. There is a very slight difference. I think it's a sort of very fine difference, but I can see the point. Somebody needs actually to invent a word for both Treasure Island and for The House of Silk, which tries to explain exactly what these books are setting out to do. I wanted to write an original book, and there are many things in my book which Doyle didn't do. There are areas he never visited. There's a sort of a more deep felt look at poverty and injustice in 19th century London, and for some reason the Sherlock Holmes novels tend to skate over all that. So there are lots of new and different things in the book, whilst at the same time I'm trying to live very much, in fact entirely and very rigorously, within the Doyle world. So what I'm trying to get at is that it is a completely original book, but which couldn't have existed without Doyle's work.
I was quite interested to see your Watson writing that Holmes had accused him more than once of vulgar romanticism and thought him no better than any Grub Street scribbler. Is that a reflection on the style that this book has forced you into?
No, not at all. I have a huge admiration for both Watson's style and Doyle's. I mean, they're both, in their own way, superlative writers. And one of the things that I did, I think, bring to the table, as it were, in my own book, was the idea of Watson as a famous writer, because in the Holmes stories, he's always there in the present tense, and so his reputation hasn't yet grown. But by 1914, having written the 60 novels and short stories that are the Doyle canon, the Holmes canon, that is, he must have become quite a celebrated writer himself. So I'm quite interested in him as not just a doctor and not just as a friend of Holmes, but as a writer in his own right.
So there's a sort of self-deprecation there, which is his and not yours.
Well, it's actually Holmes's, because in the books, Holmes does occasionally sneer at Watson's prose style. And Watson, for his term, does mention that Holmes never read any serious literature himself. So it actually still comes out of Doyle, even if it is a slightly wider perspective.
OK, so let's just talk a little bit about the characters. There's a lovely bit with Lestrade, where Watson apologises to him. He's dead as well, but says that he's rather ashamed of having referred to him as rat-faced and ferret. And then, of course, he goes on to refer to him as rat-faced and ferret-like.
Yes. As with Stevenson, Doyle provided me with this extraordinary cast. I mean, Lestrade, Mrs. Hudson, Mycroft, Moriarty, they all had to be in there. but I was determined that with the minor characters, I would be a little bit more tricksy, if you like, but I wouldn't do what was expected. So, for example, in the books, he tends to be a little bit simplistic and, of course, always gets it wrong. It was one of Doyle's inventions, I think, the policeman who gets it wrong, paving the way for the detective who always gets it right. But because my Watson is older and because so much time has passed and because Holmes is dead, I think a certain re-evaluation goes on. And in the book, Lestrade is actually extremely useful. Holmes would not survive the story, let alone solve the case, if it weren't for Lestrade. And therefore, Watson does him the favour of thinking the better of him, even though, as you correctly say, he does still fall back on those terrible descriptions.
He has that nice line that maybe he also was a little bit intimidated. Maybe it was that Lestrade was intimidated in Holmes's...
Yes,
presence.
I think that's right. I mean, Watson is also reevaluating his own role in all this. I mean, and, you know, he is far from an unintelligent man. And in fact, it's a modern perspective that makes Watson foolish. In the books, he's never that. He's professional. He's very humane. He's obviously a successful doctor. He was never a simpleton. And I think there's a little bit of the play in that, too, as Watson sort of establishes for himself his role in the canon.
OK, now I'm going to bring in at this point Sarah Crown, who's the editor of the book's website, and film writer Zan Brooks, because obviously this has quite a big film dimension as well, which you have been involved in, Anthony, haven't you?
Well, at the moment, curiously, I'm writing Arsène Lupin for the company that makes Sherlock Holmes. Arsène Lupin was the French invention, a sort of a rival to Sherlock Holmes, but he's not a detective, he's a thief. And they're hoping to do a franchise now with him.
Ah. Now, Zan, is there not something rather reactionary in the culture that is making us go back to digging up old things rather than creating new things?
It's interesting, isn't it? When Anthony was talking, I was thinking, I wonder why in literature this is seen as fresh and novel and born out of kind of enthusiasm for the characters and a desire to take them in fresh directions, whereas in film it's seen as reductive and cynical, possibly just because film is more industrialised and it's been there for longer and Anthony was able to do what he liked with the characters. But generally in film, if somebody is rebooting a franchise, it's a producer's medium and the director is told exactly what to do with this story. I think there was something like 9 out of the 10 top grossing films of last year were either sequels or prequels or sort of series. So it has become the kind of default position for Hollywood. And I guess it makes sense on a business level because it's a pre-sold films for a pre-sold audience. There's that sort of familiarity.
The figures are quite extraordinary. I was looking up a list of sequels by box office improvement, from which I discovered that Terminator 2, Judgment Day, made more than 4 times as much as the Terminator, the original Terminator.
Yeah, but the original Terminator was almost like... It was a B-movie, basically. It wasn't seen as a big A-list Hollywood movie in the way that Terminator 2 was when that came along 7 years later, I think. Terminator 1 almost fell through the cracks. What's interesting to think of as well is how this might have affected Hollywood narrative, that we were used up until the sort of 70s or 80s to seeing films as standalone films, that they had a resolution, whether it was a ironclad conclusion or a hanging ending. Whereas now the pressure is on filmmakers to kind of reset the clock to zero, like in the hope that there'll be another film and another film and another film after that. So that has weird implications in terms of script writing, I would have thought.
How's that affected you, Anthony?
It changes from project to project. I mean, I'm also working on Tintin. Now, Tintin is a very rigorous and very regulated job because I'm actually doing exactly what has just been described. I'm having to fit very much into the groove of what has been created, and I am part of a very, very large machine and a very small cog within it. Arsène Lupin, however, and this is early days, I haven't yet been fired or replaced or whatever, so far I've been given complete creative freedom. But then that is slightly different because the franchise doesn't yet exist.
Sarah, there's a whole element of this which is about ventriloquism, isn't there?
You can do what you like with the story is absolutely fine, but if you don't have the voice of the original author, then I think you're kind of toast, really, because the people who, your readership, you have a ready-made readership of people who are going to want to buy your book and read it because it's reuniting the characters from the books that they really loved. And if you don't do it in the way that they want you to do it, in the way that they expect, in terms of the voices of the characters, then I think it just doesn't work. I was thinking, when Anthony was talking, actually, that the image that comes to mind is of a house where you're building an extension. It doesn't matter what you put in the room, but if it doesn't blend in with the rest of the house, then it looks wrong and ugly and ungainly, and it just sort of doesn't stand up.
I'm not sure I have ventriloquism. Does that make me the dummy, I wonder? It is certainly true, though, what Sarah is saying about the voice having to be accurate, having to be exactly there. Although that said, I mean, when I read the Sebastian Fawkes Bond, I thought that a lot of the characters spoke to each other in ways that Fleming would never have permitted, particularly the housekeeper, Bond's attitude to M. When Jeffrey Deaver comes along, suddenly Bond is born so late that if it was the original Bond, he'd be about 76 or something, because it's the same name, but it's a completely different idiom. So it's very odd what actually is going on here. What are the qualities that you can take from the original book, beyond just the names and the sort of the scenarios, if you like, that make these books work?
Was there ever a point where you thought, I want to do something completely outrageous with this character that takes him in a completely outlandish new direction?
No, because lots of Holmes pastiches have done that. I mean, obviously there have been, you know, Watson was a clever one, Holmes was a stupid one, Holmes is a woman, Holmes meets Tarzan, Holmes meets Jack the Ripper, Holmes meets Hitler. And I started from a reverence towards Doyle. I love his writing, and I know that he's a much, much better writer than me. And so I just didn't want to muck it up.
One of the books that Sarah and I were talking about before this was Rebecca's Tale by Sally Bowman, which is a sequel to Rebecca, Daphne du Maurier. And I was looking back through the reviews, and Linda Grant said that while both du Maurier and Bowman are great storytellers, Bowman really is the better prose writer.
Sentence for sentence, I think Rebecca is an incredibly sort of driven and exciting story, but probably Bowman's sequel was that sort of touch more elegant and
more literary, perhaps.
Yeah,
is that what
a little
about?
Bit more literary. And then again, you know, that sort of becomes interesting as well, because you think when du Maurier was writing, she wasn't seen as a literary author. As time's gone by, that the canon has sort of accepted her, and so possibly Bowman's approach to it was informed by the way that our attitudes have changed towards Daphne du Maurier.
Well, lastly, let's leave it on a mystery, the note of a mystery. You have two conflicting lines in The House of Silk. One is that Watson says there are several stories in the early life of Sherlock Holmes that remained untold because they were too horrific at the time. And the other line is, of course, that Sherlock is now dead. Are we to gather from this that you've decided that you aren't going to do more, or that you're leaving yourself open the opportunity of doing more?
I can say categorically I'm not going to write another Sherlock Holmes novel, because I think that, frankly, I can't see that I could do better than I've already done, and it would be a sort of a diminishing return. However, I do intend to write another book set in the 19th century. Sherlock Holmes will make a fleeting appearance in its pages, so it very much belongs to his world. The only thing is that he won't really be in it.
There's loads still to talk about, isn't there? So do join in on the page below this podcast. If you've come to us from iTunes, you can find the place at guardian.co.uk/books and click podcast on the navigation bar at the top of the page. And yet again, can I encourage you to subscribe as well, and even encourage your friends and literary acquaintances to do so too. Now, Sarah has stayed with me to tell you what else we have to look forward to in this coming week.
Yes, and in Saturday Review this weekend, we have Ian McEwan writing on originality in science and literature. And he'll also be appearing at the Guardian Open Weekend on Sunday morning as well. And on the literary side of the weekend, in fact, it features about 200 events. And we have a few tickets left for a book club with Robert Harris on Saturday at 3 p.m. And he'll be talking about his novel Fatherland with John Mullen. So if you're interested, you can still book for that at guardian.co.uk/open-weekend.
And we have tickets on Sunday for an event I'll be chairing with Fiona Shaw on love poetry. We'll be taking your favourite lines and poems for possible inclusion in a cultural Olympiad project called Peace Camp, which Fiona and Deborah Warner are doing with the street arts company Artichoke. So do come along and introduce yourselves and your favourite love lines. And that's it for this week. If you missed our Mother's Day short story podcasts last week, do listen into them. A mother is not just for Mother's Day, is she, Sarah?
No.
And they are really genuinely great. Thanks very much, Sarah. Also to Andrew Motion, Anthony Horowitz, Zan Brooks, and all those readers, some of whom you may have recognised from podcasts past. I'm Claire Armistead. From me and my producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.